Lecture 3, Hegel's Philosophy of Freedom, God, and the State.
We've now reached the point in time in this third lecture on freedom of 19th century Europe. And at this time and place, there occurred an extraordinary burst of political theory, especially in thinking about freedom. Perhaps this flowering of thought was stirred by the rise of a powerful middle class concerned about freedom of commerce, perhaps by the American and French revolutions in the late 18th century. Perhaps it was stirred by the stimulation of philosophers like Locke and Rousseau. But whatever the reason, the 19th century marks the high water mark in its philosophizing about freedom in history thus far. And the two major philosophers, George Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel and John Stuart Mill, expound two sharply contrasting views of freedom that are diametrically opposed as they are influential. This lecture will be devoted entirely to George Hegel, the next one to John Stuart Mill. But the two should be seen as a pair of contrasts, as we viewed Locke and Rousseau in the second lecture as contrasts. Now, I've titled this lecture, Hegel's Philosophy of Freedom, God, and the State, because these three concepts are so closely knit in his philosophy, each depending on the other, just as Locke's idea of freedom was necessarily dependent on his concepts of social contract and property. But Hegel did not build on the ideas of Locke. Mill did that, as we'll see next time. Hegel built on the philosophies of Plato, Christianity, and Rousseau. When I say this, that Hegel was influenced more by one group of thinkers than another, I mean to suggest that more than just a fact of intellectual history. I want to state the main theme of these lectures so far, and this is that there are two distinct ways of thinking about freedom, and that these two ways could be seen as early as 1000 BC in the Indian Upanishads, in the concept of Swaraj, or freedom, as I tried to explain in our very first lecture, but that by the 19th century, the century we're in now as we treat Hegel and then later Mill, these two ways of thinking about freedom take dramatically opposed forms in the philosophies of Hegel and Mill. The crystallization of these two views of freedom is a major philosophical event of the 19th century. It forms what we may call two rival schools of thought. One school of thought about freedom, derived from Plato and Christianity, synthesized by Hegel, continued by Karl Marx, conceived of freedom as liberation from ignorance or illusion, by achieving some form of knowledge or higher consciousness, as it's best expressed by Christ's dictum, the truth shall set you free. The other opposed view of freedom, also present in ancient thought, but synthesized especially by Locke and Mill to British theorists, said simply that we're free when we're not controlled by some form of arbitrary authority, whether that arbitrary authority is a tyrannical state or what Mill called the tyranny of the majority, a phrase that we'll be analyzing in the next lecture. These two schools of thought clash especially over how freedom relates to authority. Whereas Hegel welcomes the authority of the ideal state because the state can liberate the individual and, as it were, force him to be free, Locke and Mill are suspicious of authority to the extreme, and they want a limited parliamentary system of government, that is, freedom under law and laws established carefully through contract. So as we turn now to Hegel, we must keep in mind the importance of his theories of God and state to his idea of freedom, and how all in turn relate to his notion of authority as a means of liberation. Hegel was born in Stuttgart in 1770, which was then in Prussia, now in Germany. He studied as a young man in a theological university. And though he chose not to become a theologian, he chose instead to become a professor of philosophy and achieved a very prestigious post at the University of Berlin in philosophy, chair of philosophy in the early 19th century. Although he chose then academe rather than the church, he nevertheless remained intensely involved in religious speculation. And we'll see this in a moment when we stress the connection of his idea of God to his concept of freedom. Hegel sets forth his theory of freedom in his major work, The Philosophy of History. And he significantly opens this treatise with a strong statement of his view of God. Well, we quote Hegel, "The world is not abandoned to accident and chance. It is controlled by providence. A divine providence presides over the events of the entire world, a wisdom endowed with infinite power, which realizes its own aim, that is, the final absolute purpose of the world, which is freedom. If God's wisdom is manifest in animals, in plants, and individual lives, then why not in world history? God is all-powerful, and so exercises his wisdom on a grand scale. He governs the world, and the actual working of his government, the carrying out of his plan, is the history of the world. Philosophy strives to comprehend God's grand design, for only that which has been carried out according to God's plan is true." Now, philosophers and theologians before Hegel had, of course, conceived of God as an omnipotent, a benevolent often force that controlled human affairs, that determined all life, an infinite power. That goes back to early Christianity and, of course, before. Hegel applies, though, in the context of his Christian vision, this view of God to his philosophy of history, asserting that world history must be viewed as a grand drama with God as the sole author. When we get to his theory of freedom, we'll see that Hegel does not regard people as being able to write the script for this drama themselves. It is God alone who writes the script. We are free only insofar as we become conscious of God's plan and then cooperate with it by freely performing our roles in history. If we play these roles well, then we're free agents insofar as we're acting according to his plan, because truth has set us free. If we do not, then we're enslaved to an illusion. And the illusion is that we are the creators of history. An illusion that will be overcome only if we come to know God. Knowing God is to become aware of our own natures, because we have a divine essence. We have a soul within, a spark of the divine that is for us to realize. Most of us are alienated from that essence. We are unaware of its purpose or its power. Hegel develops the concept newly, in an original way, of alienation, as it had not been developed before. Now, that is, Christianity and other religions early on had said that the soul was divided from the body, and the body-mind or body-soul division certainly can be found before Christianity. Hegel builds on that idea, but the concept of alienation here is special, and while it begins in terms of an individual alienated within, as we'll see, it takes a political turn. Later on, he develops it in his political philosophy to one state alienated from another state. The concept of alienation is this, that there is essence and there is existence. Essence is divine. Existence is matter. And ultimately, in spiritual eternal terms, it is illusion. Our task is to realize our essence. And that is a special task assigned to us as human beings, because only in humanity does this divine essence preside. Only in humanity is there an opportunity to realize it. Alienation occurs when we fail to realize the God within, when we turn away from the essence and are consumed only with existence. Existence is physical, it will die. Essence is eternal, it cannot perish because it's part of God himself. Now, Hegel develops a concept of human nature that sees human nature following it logically from his concept of God. He explains it in his Philosophy of History. And note once again that he does call his major text the Philosophy of History, because as we'll see, God's plan is the working out in history of a particular design. He speaks about human nature in these terms. We have in our human nature two parts, those of matter and those of spirit, those of existence and of essence. The realm of spirit is the kingdom of God within us, and it must be realized as such. The realm of spirit is all comprehensive, and we are creatures within which the spirit works. Our purpose in the course of history is to seize the advantage before us, at which spirit and matter unite, for they meet only in us, in human nature. Now, we want to note how Hegel assigns then to human nature this special destiny. We're unique in the universe because only in us, in our physical being, has God chosen in his infinite wisdom to work. Our destiny is not simply to nod our heads in recognition of this phenomenon, as one nods, say, at the preaching of a Sunday sermon, but rather to realize the uncanny opportunity that we have as God's creatures. It's at this point that Hegel speaks explicitly of freedom, identifying it as a godlike quality for us to know and us to appreciate. He says this: if the opposite of spirit is matter, then the essence and substance of spirit is freedom. Freedom is the sole truth of spirit. And as we must discover the meaning of spirit, so must we also know the truth of freedom. For I am free when I am conscious of my divine self by overcoming self-alienation. Scholars have tried to sort out that passage, believe me, for decades, and volumes have been spent on trying to tell precisely what Hegel meant by the concept of freedom. Well, we can begin. He certainly didn't mean what Locke meant by the idea of freedom. He means spiritual freedom, moral freedom, but clearly he means more than that, too. Note the passage. Let's go over the passage and try to sort it out. We've said that the opposite of spirit is matter. That is, there's essence and existence. But then he says, the essence and the substance of spirit is freedom. Freedom is the sole truth of spirit. And we must discover the meaning of spirit so we'll know the truth of freedom. And then finally, I am free when I am conscious of my divine self by overcoming self-alienation. What does he mean? Well, he means to start with that freedom is a state of consciousness within us, a capacity that enables us to know God. It's a kind of window of opportunity that if we'll use it, will sweep away the ignorance and illusions that we have and allow us to understand the real purpose of humanity, which is to comprehend God's plan and glorify his wisdom. So we should understand his idea of freedom as spiritual freedom, as a liberation of the spirit within us that enables us to know God, to discover our soul. And he speaks of our need then to overcome alienation or estrangement from our divine self and gain an awareness of God. He says that freedom is a higher, a spiritual consciousness, a free spirit. and it comes as a gradual process in which we gain greater enlightenment. In his own words, he says, freedom is not natural and innate. It must be acquired and won. It is possible only through an arduous process of the discipline of knowledge and willpower, obedience to law and observance of morality. Again, pause and comment on that. Freedom is obedience in the sense that once we gain awareness of God's plan, we will, truth having set us free, obey God's will. We will realize, as limited creatures in history, we are not God. We can know God, but we cannot be God. As relatively limited in terms of our action, we will realize that our task in history is not to create history, but to execute history, because we haven't written the script. We execute history as players will execute history in a grand drama, as players will execute their parts. And that grand drama has a purpose. Is it conceivable, Hegel says, as he reviews the march of civilization, the way in which a consciousness of freedom has grown since the early times, is it conceivable that all of this has come about as a result of an accident? That is, that the way in which individuals, say, in China during the Han Dynasty, viewed freedom in such a limited sense, where only at best the emperor could claim some freedom. Now we move up through Greece. We've seen how in Greece they have developed a civic sense of freedom. And Plato has enlarged upon it and showed us how, considering the task before us, freedom can be enlarged and understood through enlightenment. And after that burst of knowledge and enlightenment in Greece, now we get an emerging state of freedom and consciousness of freedom in modern Europe. That whole drama from Asia to ancient Europe to modern Europe speaks of a plan, a kind of consciousness that's emerged as a result of humans being more and more able to execute what God intended. And what he intended was that we should become more and more aware of this plan, and that would be freedom. The concepts here of history, or the concepts of history and of alienation, are important. We've talked about history in terms of the way in which world history spells this drama out, from the birth of the concept of freedom, perhaps in Asia, to the growing realization of it in Greece, and then the increased awareness of it in modern Europe. But it's also, Hegel says, a way in which individuals have worked through this problem of alienation. That is, they initially were not aware of it at all. Then more and more there's consciousness of the division between essence and existence, of the alienation between the mind and the body, or the divine self and the existence of the body. That kind of alienation, from Hegel's point of view, is being more and more overcome throughout history. We more and more realize that we are at one with God and not estranged from him. And that has come about especially through Christianity. Hegel says that the highest kind of freedom, the freedom in which truly we will become aware of the divine, can occur only in a Christian society. Christianity has given us this kind of awareness. And from his point of view, Christianity has prepared us more and more for an understanding of where we are philosophically. It was Christ who said, "The truth shall set ye free." And when he said that, he was heralding a whole way of thinking and of acting that would become more and more important. And Hegel seizes on this and says it only awaits, it needs the development of philosophy. And philosophy will give to that early Christian insight what's necessary. What's necessary is a way of thinking that will achieve a union of God, a full union of God, and no longer being alienated from him. Now, Hegel distinguished, as Plato and Rousseau did, between two types of freedom. But he made the distinction much more clearly and sharply than they had. Hegel said that there is an inferior type of freedom, a definitely inferior type of freedom that he calls simply negative freedom. And he identifies this negative freedom with caprice and whim. He says it's characterized by the license of selfish desires. This is clearly a put-down of the Lockean or the liberal notion of freedom, which Hegel derides as no more than license. The other kind of freedom, which is the true, real, authentic form of freedom, is the one that Hegel praises. And this we attain only when the truth sets us free, when we become aware of the essence or spirit within us that's God, when we exercise the God-given capacity of our free spirit and consciousness to know our real selves. Hegel calls this freedom positive rather than negative, and it must be acquired and won, he says, through struggle. Struggle to overcome the alienation that we may feel from our higher selves. Now, at the beginning of our comments on Hegel, I said that three concepts would be the focus of our lecture, and that is the concepts of freedom, of God, and the state. And so far we haven't mentioned Hegel's idea of the state. The theory of the state or nation is central to Hegel's thought because he believes that the state has been chosen by God to play a leading role in his drama. But the concept of the state did not come right away to Hegel. Hegel began as a philosopher not of the state but of the individual. And in his earlier work, published in 1806, called The Phenomenology of Being, in that early work he saw the conflict between essence and existence as occurring within the individual. The individual's attempt was to overcome alienation, to know God, and to execute his, mainly his, women are not often mentioned, his role in history. That attempt on the part of Hegel to focus on individual self-realization is all important in his earlier work. As he develops his philosophy, he becomes more and more political. And he takes the division that occurs in every individual between essence and existence. He takes the alienation that each of us feels between our divine state and our material state. He takes that and he transfers it into the world scale of a conflict between states. And so the conflict within each individual is now taken up as a conflict between two states, often at war with one another, one carrying the divine spirit and the other not. Hegel's concept then of the state is all important. He's clear that all states will not have the role of major player to perform. Only those that God has chosen and God has deemed worthy, and we cannot know why he has selected some states and not others. We can, by studying history, tell which states have had a divine sanction, because God selects to fulfill his design those states that can and have exercised most power, and God is not concerned with losers. He chooses states that will further his cause. And so those states that have grown to great power, imperial power, marshaling great empires, are those states that truly represent the way in which God means plans his design in history. Who, what is the carrier of the divine spirit? Well, Hegel was concerned only initially, as I said, with individuals. Now he becomes, as he becomes a professor of history at philosophy at the University of Berlin, he becomes more and more concerned with politics and with states, in particular now the German state. And he finds, when he looks at history, that the march of history has been carried on more and more by states. And the nature of the contest is one between one state that will build an empire to a certain degree, come into conflict with another state. A clash will occur and the divine spirit will be furthered in history as a result of the outcome. And so when Hegel speaks of conflict and struggle, he sanctions these, not just as necessary, but as desirable in the course of world history. When he speaks of conflict, he speaks of overcoming alienation. And the way in which we overcome alienation is as members of a particular state, which hopefully for us carries the divine spirit, we become members of that state and strive with and through that state to overcome the alienation that exists throughout the world. It's at this point, then, that the personal becomes the political. Heretofore, Hegel's philosophy may have had limited interest in his early works. Now it takes on, especially in Germany, throughout Europe, major interest when he speaks of certain states carrying a divine spirit. He becomes now a philosopher of nationalism. And no single concept in the 19th century marshals more political power around it, not even the concept of freedom, than the concept of nationalism. And as we know, that concept of nationalism is carried through into the 20th century, in which even today it is the major political phenomenon of our time. God selects, then, certain states to fulfill his design. So when Hegel views history, he now examines states that have become great empires. In China, Greece, Rome, the ancient world was controlled by vast political powers. The historians before Hegel may have looked at this and seen it as being of some interest. Now we see it as part of a design, and that design is a growing consciousness of freedom in the world. God wanted it this way. God laid the foundations for the progressive realization of his plan and for the onward march of freedom. And so this is what Hegel says about the state. The state is the divine idea as it exists on earth. The state is the agent of world history. The state is the source of the genuine moral life and the highest expression of morality. It is the positive reality and the satisfaction of freedom. The state does not exist for its citizens. On the contrary, the state is the end, and they are its means. They are parts of the state, like members of an organic body. As such, the state is the realization of the highest freedom, of positive freedom, and serves an absolute final purpose, God's purpose on earth. All the value that the individual has, all his spiritual reality, he has only through the state, because the state is the very condition for the realization of his freedom. And he realizes this freedom on the stage of world history only if he is in a state selected by God through conflict, overcoming alienation. Well, there's a lot in that passage, charged with nationalism. The state, the divine idea as it exists on earth. The state now, not a single individual, but the state becomes the carrier of God's purpose. The state, the agent of history. History moves ahead only through nation states. And we want to note this because it is so important in Western political philosophy as opposed to Eastern political philosophy. And that is the way in which at this point in Western political philosophy, struggle and conflict is brought to the fore. Hegel, as a philosopher, represents a mainstream now of thinking about politics, which indicates that only through conflict and struggle can progress occur. We might take this for granted today, that is, the necessity of competition for progress. But it was not taken for granted before the 19th century so much. And in the East, in Asian thought, in Chinese and Indian thought, it was certainly not assumed. That is, the assumption there was that progress occurred insofar as we achieved harmony with nature, harmony among ourselves. Whereas for Hegel, only struggle and conflict can assure the overcoming of alienation. So we overcome alienation and division through conflict. And as the self is torn in a state of alienation between essence and existence, so now the world becomes torn between conflicting empires or conflicting states. And this is necessary and desirable. This is the stuff of history. Now he says further, note, the source of the genuine moral life and the highest expression of morality is only in the state. It's the positive reality and satisfaction of freedom. He's linking here the state with God, but the state with the expression of the highest moral life. That is, we obey the state, not because we're afraid of the state, but because we know that the state sets forth a set of norms and laws that if it is the right state, remember we're always inserting that important qualification and proviso, if it happens to be the state chosen by God to advance the course of world history and overcome alienation, if it's the right state, then it represents the highest moral life. And we find morality in, then, the system of laws that that state sets forth. And then it's the positive reality and satisfaction of freedom. The positive reality and satisfaction of freedom can occur then only in the state. Individual freedom outside the state that God has selected to further the course of world history, that is not possible. We achieve freedom then not as single individuals, but as members of an organic body. And as he continues in this passage, the state doesn't exist for its citizens. The state is the end. They are its means. They are parts of the state like members of an organic body. The concept of the state as an organic body began in Plato's Republic. Plato in the Republic says that we must create a state that is so harmonious, so unified, that just as in a single individual, that individual will feel pain at the loss of one of his members, so we must create a state that's so unified that each individual in the state will feel loss or grieve over each of its members as extremely as we would feel loss over one of our leg or our arm. That suggestion of the state as an organic body is carried on through political philosophy until we get to Hegel. And notice the implications of it for Hegel. The state is the organic body. That is, we are knitted together in the state to such a degree that just as the arm doesn't enter into a state of conflict with the heart over which is superior, the body organizes in terms of a hierarchy with certain organs being superior to other organs in terms of our own existence, so in the state there will be a hierarchy. And in the state, one part of the state will obey another part of the state instinctively and intuitively. And that is freedom. It's freedom to know one's place in the state, to be assured that one's ultimate realization of God can occur only within this, that the state is the end and the people, the citizens, are only the means to its fulfillment. Hegel's theory of the state, then, shows that he was a political philosopher above all, who emphasized the primary role of politics in the struggle for spiritual truth. But it was not just any politics or any state, as he said, that would enhance or further the pursuit of God and truth. Most of the world's states or nations at any given point are not chosen by God and so will play no part in his plan. They're consigned to the dustbin of history. They're the victims of larger, more powerful states, because they cannot carry on the struggle. Even among the most powerful states, God cannot be on the side of both states in a major conflict between them. We may tell which one he has chosen by who wins, by which one survives, prevails, to advance his purpose, but there must be conflict. In the early part of human history, God chose states in Asia, China, and India to form huge Oriental empires that glorified his plan. Then the divine spirit leapt to Greece, where the Athenian Empire performed its brief but spectacular role on the stage, including Alexander the Great's conquest of India, before giving way to the magnificent power of the Roman Empire. And Hegel discusses each one of these entities in terms of the part that they have to play, and saying that the Germanic peoples now have a decisive role to play in history. In each case, the test of greatness, then, of whether God has chosen, lies with the political power, the will, and the capacity to prevail. The march of freedom demands winners, not losers. And we overcome our alienation from the spirit within us only within a state that can sustain conflict. Now, one of the most remarkable parts of Hegel's philosophy of history, I think, is its account of what Hegel calls the hero in history, the great leader, the world historical individual, as he calls him. Hegel believes that God selects not only states to serve his purpose, but great leaders of states, not individuals apart from the state, but leaders who become one with their states and advance the cause of the state, and turn the state indeed into a powerful empire. It's noteworthy that the heroes whom Hegel discusses are both political leaders and military geniuses. Alexander the Great, Julius Caesar, and Napoleon are his world historical individuals. They're able to seize political power and to exploit it to the fullest. And they're able to seize it often, most often, through military conflict. And we want to note how the concepts of alienation and conflict begin on a personal level, then they move to the state level, then they take the form of the person, the hero within the state, who has great military meaning and force. Let's listen to Hegel's own words about the hero in history. I think this is the best part of the philosophy of history, when he describes his world historical individuals. Historical men, world historical individuals, are those who grasp a higher universal, make it their own purpose, and realize this purpose in accordance with the higher law of the spirit. Caesar was such a man. He was motivated not only by his own private interest, but acted instinctively to bring to pass that which the times required. It's the same with all great historical individuals. Their own particular purposes contain the substantial will of the world spirit. They must be called heroes, as I call them, insofar as they have derived their purpose and vocation not from the calm, regular course of things sanctioned by the existing order, but from a secret source whose content is still hidden and has not yet broken through into existence. The source of their actions is the inner spirit, still hidden beneath the surface, but already knocking against the outer world as against the shell in order finally to burst forth and break it into pieces. Such individuals, heroes in history, have no consciousness of the idea as such. They're practical and political men. But at the same time, they're thinkers with insight into what is needed and timely. They see the very truth of their age and their world. Spirit is the innermost soul of all individuals. But spirit exists in a state of unconsciousness, which the great men arouse to consciousness. For this reason, their fellow men fly to them, follow their soul leaders. They stream to their banner, for they feel the irresistible power of their own spirit embodied in their heroes. I think that's a priceless passage that explains much of our theory of charismatic leadership that we've set forth in the 20th century. These great men seem only to follow their passion and their arbitrary wills, but what they really pursue is the universal. The deeds of the great men, who are the individuals of world history, thus appear justified not only in their intrinsic unconscious significance, but from the point of view of world history and freedom. It's irrelevant and inappropriate from that point of view to raise moral claims against world historical heroes. They stand outside of morality. The litany of the private virtues of modesty, humility, love, and charity must not be raised against them. So you see, we have the suggestion of Nietzsche's Superman, that is, the individual who can rise above morality. These individuals, unlike the common citizen who will realize freedom through following law, these individuals are ahead of their time. And like Caesar and Napoleon and Alexander, they forecast great empires. A world historical individual is not so sober as to adjust his ambition to circumstances, nor is he very considerate. He is devoted, come what may, to one purpose. Therefore, such men may treat other great and even sacred interests inconsiderately, a conduct which indeed subjects them to moral reprehension. But so mighty a figure must trample down many an innocent flower, crush to pieces many things in its path. These world historical individuals were fortunate in being the agents of a purpose which constitutes a step in the progress of the universal spirit and its realization of freedom. But as individuals distinguished from their substantial aim, they were not what is commonly called happy, nor did they want to be. They wanted to achieve their aim, and they achieved it by their toil and labor. They succeeded in finding their satisfaction in bringing about their purpose, the universal purpose. With such a grand aim, they had the boldness to challenge all the opinions of men. Thus they attained no common enjoyment for themselves. Their whole life was labor and trouble. Their whole being was in their passion. Once their objective is attained, they fall off like empty hulls from the colonel. They die early like Alexander. They are murdered like Caesar. They are transported to St. Helena like Napoleon. Well, this is the agent of world history. The individual, the hero, who can lead his state to a realization of freedom. The world historical individual or hero in history leads the charge then in the fight for freedom. He's God's servant in the cause of divine destiny. He brings his state to a climax and his people to a state of sublime realization. Hegel's theory is expressed most succinctly in the lines about the hero that, as I said, I like most. Spirit is the innermost soul of all individuals, but it exists in a state of unconsciousness. The great men arouse this spirit to consciousness, so their fellow men stream to their banner because they feel the irresistible power of their own spirit embodied in them. That's the function of the hero. And note the emphasis now upon the realization of the spirit through the individual hero in history. It's in all of us, but the hero shows us the way toward the realization of the power within each. And note how this description of political leadership summarizes Hegel's views about freedom, God, and the state. The hero leads us to freedom by inspiring within us the realization of our spirit. We are awakened because of his power, but we are awakened to the power within ourselves. This is God's will and God's power. And these leaders would be powerless were it not for the state, which they use as an agent of his will and his design, which must be the attainment of freedom. The focus in Hegel's philosophy is consistently on freedom, and he concludes the philosophy of history with his grand affirmation of the theme of freedom. Freedom is itself, he says, its own object of attainment and the sole purpose of spirit. It's the ultimate purpose through which all history is continually aimed. To this end, all the sacrifices have been offered on the vast altar of the earth throughout the long lapse of ages. Freedom alone is the purpose which realizes and fulfills itself, the only enduring pole in the change of events and conditions, the only truly efficient principle that pervades the whole. This final aim is God's purpose with the world, but God is the absolutely perfect being and can therefore will nothing but himself, his own will. The nature of his own will, his own nature, is what then we call here the idea of freedom. So Hegel explicitly called his theory the idea of freedom. And he contributed through this idea what was not there earlier in the theories of Plato and Christianity, or Locke or Rousseau. He did this by connecting the idea of freedom with at least two really new concepts. The first is his idea of freedom being an unfolding of God's purpose in history. That's new. The idea that we will become more and more liberated and conscious of our own destiny through the state as part of God's purpose in history, that is Hegel's contribution. Rousseau had distinguished between moral or spiritual freedom, but Hegel is the first to link this to history, to God. So the story of our existence on this planet becomes a history of freedom, an increasingly greater realization of freedom, which is at one with God's plan for humanity. His second contribution is, of course, that of nationalism. No theorist gave more substance and inspiration to the theory and practice of nationalism as Hegel did. He placed the state or the nation at the front of the stage of world history as the agent of God's will. The nation's state was where all the action was committed. That is an indispensable instrument of human progress and freedom for Hegel. And without it, there can be no freedom. So God selects the state that will carry out his plan, and the leader of the state becomes the hero that will achieve it. The theory then gives a divine sanction to political power as well as to military power when these infuse a state and a leader who represents the cause of freedom.